This episode of Midori House was first broadcast on the 30th of June 2015 on Monocle 24.
Hello and welcome to Midori House, coming to you live from Studio One here in London. I'm Steve Bloomfield. On today's programme, Greece. It's still there and we're still talking about it. As the country slips ever closer to financial implosion, I'll be asking my guests, Tim Marshall and Jeffrey Kaufman, how did we end up in this mess? Then we'll focus on Dilma Rousseff, the Brazilian president who is in Washington today to meet Barack Obama and trying to put past hang-ups such as the meddling of the NSA in her home country's private communications to one side. We'll also be looking back at the grim spectacle that is 1 year of the self-proclaimed caliphate in Iraq and Syria. Islamic State is not going away, so we'll be analysing what can be done about its brutal regime. All that, plus why Ukraine is looking to Hollywood talent to help win the power struggle with neighbouring Russia. That's all to come on Midori House with me, Steve Bloomfield. So welcome to Midori House. My guests today are Tim Marshall, editor of thewhatandthewhy.com and former diplomatic editor of Sky News, and the author and commentator Jeffrey Kaufman. Tim and Jeffrey, welcome both to the programme. We begin today in some familiar territory, Greece. The country has in the past few hours requested a last-minute bailout deal from its European international creditors, but we're no closer to learning whether it will be able to stave off tonight's deadline to pay back 1.6 billion euros to the International Monetary Fund. We're now nearing what may well be the end in some form of Greece's epic struggle with the European Union, but on tonight's Midori House, we're asking, how did this situation arise in the first place? And could there have been anything done by either Europe or Greece to ensure a more positive outcome? Tim, where do we even begin? Do we begin back with the original bailouts in 2010? Do we begin back in 1999 when Greece joined the euro?
Well, you do start there, but first you say that contrary to all the commentary of the past year, that it's not tragedy, it is farce. It is an epic, but it's an epic farce, and that farce began in 99. Greece actually wasn't allowed in straight away. They couldn't meet the terms. They still couldn't meet the terms in 2001. They were allowed in time for the notes and the coins actually to go out and to go to Greece. But here's why it was a farce from the beginning. There was something called the Maastricht criteria. Every country had to fit them. This was about your inflation, your unemployment, your debt, your public sector borrowing. And on every single factor, Greece was way out, should never have been allowed in. But France and Germany knew they were lying. They cooked the books. France and Germany knew they were cooking the books. So the three of them in it together are all responsible. Everybody knew they were cooking the books. And when you cook the books like that, eventually you can't defy gravity.
And Jeffrey Kaufman, here's the thing, because, you know, we can, you know, talk about, you know, the responsibility of successive Greek governments in terms of, you know, decisions they've carried out, which, as Tim suggests, weren't particularly sensible or wise or perhaps even morally right. And yet it only seems to be Greece which is suffering now. France and Germany don't seem to be paying much of a price for this at all.
You know, to pick up on what Tim was saying, I think what's very clear, and we've known this really from the beginning, was that the euro was an economic concept designed by politics, and it was always about a political union through a monetary union, and it was flawed from the beginning. And I think what you ask about Germany and France is very, very interesting, because I remember when I reported on Spain's collapse, or the economic collapse a couple of years ago, and the housing market, one of the things that really surprised me when I started digging into it was there was Angela Merkel scolding Spain for its irresponsible, profligate spending on housing. Who had financed all of that excessive housing? The Germans.
And why? For political reasons, for philosophical reasons. And when you try to squeeze philosophy into economics, it's a very, very bad fit. And the whole philosophical fit was, we will have ever closer union. Part of this ever closer union will be a single currency. Now, the fact that a single currency is going to struggle if you don't have a single market, a single language, the way the United States is, and much easier forms of movement and goods and payment, all the rest of it. I think it could work. It is still working apart from one country. But if you keep cooking the books, it won't work. And France and Germany also cook the books their own, and they twice missed their own criteria, which they themselves had set down. The European Commission had the power to fine them. Said, well, let's pretend this hasn't happened, we'll be a bit lax.
This is about deficits, isn't it?
About deficits, yes.
You can't be less than 3% over GDP.
And if you can't do that with economics, you can do it with politics. You can have a fudge agreement. Look, the Americans and the Iranians, for example, today will have some sort of fudge agreement. They'll kick the can down the road because politically, neither of them are prepared to collapse the Iran-America deal. You can do that with politics. You can't do it forever with economics, and it's coming home to roost. I think they're going to find yet another fudge, but they're going to stagger around like a drunken Euroman.
And it does. I think Tim brings up a really important point, and it's, maybe it's becoming self-evident, that there's this notion of kicking the can down the road, which has been going on now for really 16 years. Can it continue? Is Europe prepared? Does Greece have such a hold? Is there such fear of that annoying word? I'm embarrassed to use it on air, but I'm going to say it. The Grexit.
I like it.
It's a perfect tabloid word.
On this is a terrible word. Yeah, but
can the Eurozone? Can the European economy handle the trauma of a Greek exit?
I think it can, because the same came so close a few years ago. I think they have put in the mechanisms whereby there's enough, basically you've got enough stuffed in your back pocket to start paying everybody else off. Once the speculators go for Italy and Spain, there are ways of stabilizing it.
But here's the thing, Tim. Can we separate out whether the Euro project was a bad idea from whether what's happening right now and the policies of the European Central Bank and others over the last 5 years have been self-defeating? So, for example, on austerity, the austerity that the Greeks have had to swallow has clearly not worked.
No.
We can't look at the policies of the last 5 years and go, yes,
I agree.
Success.
But whilst, we're talking grand economics, I mean, it is easy to lose sight of the suffering of the people, and it is pretty desperate there, and I'm afraid I think it's going to get more desperate, at least in the short term. But yes, to answer your question, you can separate them out, because the project, if it's overseen with discipline, the way that the Germans were pretending to, I think can work. The way it's actually been handled, it can't work. Briefly on the Greek people, though, I mean, they are suffering, but again, they had a magician after magician after magician as their finance minister who'd wave a wand and their debt would disappear. They must have known it was going on. Nobody ever said to them, let's have a serious debate. You've got to retire at 65, not 55. You've got to do this, you've got to do that. And the political parties and the electorate were all in it together, and they've kicked that economic can down the road, and now it's sinking.
Jeffrey Kaufman, before we all start thinking that economics was perfect before the euro existed, let's go back to 1992 and when Britain fell out of the bottom of the exchange rate mechanism here. It had been trying to link its currency to the Deutschmark. It ended up in this complete disaster where, I think, Tim, correct me if I'm wrong, was it $15 billion?
Billion
pounds was lost in a single day. Mm. The bottom fell out of the market here. And that was then held up as an example, wasn't it? That actually sometimes individual currencies can be quite weak and be played off against each other. And that was one of the things that made European leaders say, should we all group together a bit more?
Well, I think, and I wasn't living in Europe at the time, but I remember when the UK said no to the euro, not being an economist nor an expert, I thought, that's really short-sighted, this kind of righteous island mentality. But I have to say, I was wrong in my ignorance that the UK, the pound, the sterling is strong, and the euro is volatile, and at least for now, they seem vindicated.
That does go in circles and cycles, obviously, and there is boom and bust, and the British obviously don't get it right all the time and have obviously got it wrong a lot. But I think what happened there was the British pragmatism. British are very suspicious of intellectuals, and we don't particularly like intellectual ideas. And this European project is an intellectual idea, which the British were fine to go along with until it started to put the economics into it. And then the pragmatism came in, well, hang on a minute, we don't want to fit an intellectual idea into economics. And that's why they stayed out.
Let me go back, Steve, to a point you made earlier. Was this a flawed concept? I think if they had been more disciplined about where the euro's borders were, were drawn, it would have been a much more successful concept. And I think they needed the Southern Europe, the so-called Euro zone, should never have been included. Had it been Northern Europe, Scandinavia, the Scandinavian countries that chose to enter, it would be a smaller but much stronger currency.
Yeah, that's what I mean. It's a philosophical idea that you include them as opposed to an economic idea. Because if you see it purely in economics, you say they're not getting into this club.
Right. Italy, Spain, Portugal, yeah. they wouldn't have joined either.
Very briefly, I've been banging on about this, I'm afraid, for some years now. I do believe that the European dream is crumbling to dust. It is extremely important what happens next, not just for Greece, but for everybody and about the EU, because there is a danger of direction of travel continuing, that we go back to a Europe of nation states and balances of power. And we saw what happened twice in the last century. I'm not being so alarmist as to say we're about to go into another European war, but you know that is what has saved us from fighting. And that's why we do have to, the people in charge have to handle what comes
next. But that is also why when you talk about the philosophical idea all this, there were very good reasons for that. It wasn't just a sort of, we don't believe in the nation state and we should all be together. We'd been through two horrendous wars.
And I know you want to move on, Steve, but Tim brings up a very, very important point you can't take out of the equation, because now this is a political question, more than an economic question now. And the price of letting Greece go is potentially pushing Greece into the hands of someone you don't want.
Putin.
And Putin is rubbing his hands together now, going, oh yes, come on, just give it to them. And you know, even though he can ill afford it, he would love to come in and poke the eyes of Western leaders.
And have a base in the Aegean. Yeah. That's pretty long-term stuff.
That's long-term. Okay, we're going to move on to Washington, D.C., where Brazil's President Dilma Rousseff is in town to visit her U.S. counterpart, Barack Obama. The two-day visit is the first for Dilma since 2012, with relations being a little frosty since the 2013 follow-up was cancelled due to her perhaps understandable displeasure at revelations of NSA spying on Brazilian telecommunications and internet traffic. Now, however, all that has apparently been put to one side, and Dilma Rousseff is looking to encourage US investment in the once booming Brazilian economy, which is now threatening to dip into recession. Jeffrey, is that the reason that everyone's kissed and made up?
Well. First of all, you know, the Snowden stuff was obviously difficult, and you know, her tantrum was understandable on one level. But the problem with that is you still have to play on the global stage, and you know, her reaction ultimately didn't help.
Although the fact that she was due to visit at about the moment this all came out, it put her in a slightly awkward position.
She was in a very awkward position, but she's in an even more awkward position now, because inflation in Brazil is, I think, 8.5%, just slightly below her popularity ratings, which are about 10%. And she's in deep trouble. The economy that was booming, you remember sitting around this table talking about the BRIC economies, Brazil, Russia, India, China, are is that right?
We don't include South Africa.
South Africa, the BRICS, yeah, they
We're
like
not
that.
Include
on,
that yeah.
Okay. But Brazil is not hot, shall we say, right now, and she needs investment desperately. The other thing that's very interesting about what's going on, and having covered Latin America for 10 years for ABC News, it's something that I witnessed. North America, Europe have really not been that interested in investment in South America. China, in its rapacious need for resources, has been a very big player, particularly in Brazil. And it's been very worrisome. You see this in Africa too, mind you. But it's been very worrisome to see the amount of Chinese investment going into resources, port infrastructure, transport, and the U.S. has been blithely ignoring this. And part of what this trip is very much about is restoring some balance. I mean, there is an extraordinary project being planned right now with the Chinese to build a two oceans railway from the Atlantic. Mm-hmm. In Brazil through Peru to the Pacific. They say it's a $10 billion project. I can't imagine it being anything less than $100 billion going through the Amazon.
That's not even before we get to the second Panama Canal. This time they're trying to build one through Nicaragua. I mean, it's private money, but it's actually the Chinese.
But so China's role is massive there. The thought of that railway, but it's very important that the U.S. have and the West in general have some economic influence in that area, and she needs the money. That their economy is really in trouble.
And Tim, does America Is America paying enough attention to what it used to call its backyard?
It is now. It did take its eye off the ball for some time, and the Chinese moved straight in there, and they've done some amazing deals throughout Latin America, and America now has a genuine rival, closer to home than it would have thought. Going back to the Dilma-Obama row, I wrote, you remember the French-US row last week that they were caught spying? I wrote a spoof piece for my website, which I said, the French are shocked. Shocked, I tell you, at the fact they're being spied upon. The Elysee Palace told the whatandthewhy.com, we're shocked at how much time we're having to spend ringing up journalists, telling them how shocked we are, and then, you know, giving interviews left, right and centre. Because the Brazilians weren't shocked in the least, neither of the French, but this is political. As you mentioned, it was just about a month before Dilma was going to go to America on a state visit. She couldn't, politically. That was two years ago. She just had to let that whole furore die down because the Brazilian people would have been so angry. Now, they're angry with her for many other reasons. They're not going to be that angry with her for going now. And Brazil needs this investment. Forgive me, I've got a book out next week which says, for example, Brazil's Atlantic ports, I think there's only 7 large ones. Total of those 7 ports cannot handle as much as one US port, New Orleans. All of them combined cannot have that much traffic. They need the investment.
Jeffrey, are they going to get that investment from the US?
Ooh, that's an interesting question. I mean, I think that what you're seeing, and you know, in reading about what she's bringing to the table, she's going to New York, and I think the West Coast. Mm-hmm. She's meeting with business leaders to say we're open for business. I think you're going to see some very very attractive offers to try to induce it, whether it comes or not. She's certainly she means business, and they will give people favorable circumstances to try to induce them.
Okay, we will leave it there just for now. Tim Marshall and Jeffrey Kaufman, thank you both very much indeed. You're listening to Midori House here on Monocle 24. We're back to talk ISIS and Russia and Ukraine right after this.
Global affairs, culture, business, design or urbanism. At Monocle 24, we've got it covered. And when it comes to transport and travel, you need look no further. From automobile innovators to the creative minds shaping the in-flight experience, we speak to the experts to ensure you have all the industry news you'll ever need. In New York, our transport editor, Tristan McAllister.
Whether it's a closer look at the global aviation heavyweights or embedding with the people who keep Alaska State Ferry System afloat, we take you to the people and the places that make our world move.
Take to the skies, the rails, the seas or the roads with Monocle 24, keeping an eye and an ear on the world.
This year sees the biggest shake-up to Monocle's 8th annual Quality of Life survey. We've added new metrics and the new additions have led to some dramatic changes. Old favourites have slipped down the list and we have a new number one.
A new and worthy winner, Monocle has made little secret of its love for Tokyo through the years. It manages to do something no other global metropolis can, provide a great quality of life for those who live there and also visit. From culture to security, food to courtesy, it has everything covered. London and New York, take note.
We hope this year's list will provoke an intelligent and lively debate. To watch an animated countdown of our 25 most livable cities for 2015, head to the film section of monocle.com.
You're listening to Midori House here on Monocle 24 with me, Steve Bloomfield. Still with me in the studio here, Jeffrey Kaufman and Tim Marshall. Yesterday marked 1 year since the radical Islamist group ISIS declared its own caliphate across Syria and Iraq. In that time, the group has waged a war on anyone, frankly, who doesn't fit its extremist ideology. And acts of barbaric cruelty, such as the murder of minorities, aid workers and journalists, have become a familiar sight. This is, of course, not to mention the spread of its message to neighbouring territories such as Tunisia, as seen in Friday's beach killings by an Islamic State-inspired militant. 1 year on from its declaration, is this level of violence something the West should just get used to as the new normal? Tim Marshall, firstly, is this as new and as dangerous and as different as many of us have been saying it is?
Yes, because although we've seen these levels of barbarity, closer to home in Europe recently, in the Bosnian War and others. What is different is that this is a modern time, it's a globalized time, there's the movement of people and all the rest of it. And also that this ideology that drives ISIS, ISIL, Daesh, whatever you want, also risks infecting the indigenous Muslim populations of Europe, which of course are growing. And if it does, it's not their problem, it is all our problem. And you have to discuss this openly, because if that, the military side of it, I wouldn't say it's easy, but it's almost easier than combating the ideological side. And the military side will go ahead. Combating the ideological side and making sure that we all get on together in our countries with a modern 21st century Islam, European Islam, that is as big a challenge as the military challenge.
I want to come back to that one in a moment, but let's just look at the idea of the military challenge, Geoffrey Kaufman. And this isn't to in any way defend the invasion of Afghanistan or put forward a view on that, but part of the reason for it, in fact, the whole reason for Afghanistan was because it was harbouring Al-Qaeda, and the West could not allow a country.
Well, it worked then. We don't talk about Al-Qaeda anymore.
Well, indeed, we don't talk about Al-Qaeda anymore. But this was a country and a regime within which there was a small group of people and they could do what they want within this. We're now talking about, you know, a huge essential state, basically, across Iraq and Syria, which isn't just harbouring a terrorist group, it is run by a terrorist group.
It was, you know, the existential question for ISIS or ISIL is exactly what the word you just hit. You know, is it a state and can it function as a state? Because, you know, will it be around, you know, where will it go in the future really depends on what services, what level it can offer to people. And you know, it is doing nominal bits of healthcare and education to say it actually makes your life better. But there's a lot of, there's hunger, there's homelessness, there's terrible hardship in the area. And I think, you know, their extremist mentality, their guns, make it very hard to unseat them. But ultimately, it can't perpetuate itself if it doesn't actually help add to the quality of life. As a terror regime on its own, that's going to be hard to sustain.
And that, Tim, is the one thing that we saw, for example, in Somalia, when first the Islamic Courts Union and then lastly Al-Shabaab tried to actually, when they held on to territory, they weren't very good at actually essentially running a state.
Not at all. That's because people at the very top of their organisation were not really fit to run a leisure centre in a small town in Austria, you know, and there they are trying to be leaders of a country. And it's the same with ISIS. They don't have the background to do it. But also, unlike a sort of terrorist state like North Korea, which is a self-contained, hermetically sealed area that isn't being bombed at the moment, they are not hermetically sealed. It's very porous. They've got lots of pockets of resistance, and they're up against an American military machine coalition, which is why they are not going to necessarily prevail. I mean, they've got a blueprint, and it's to destabilize Kuwait, further destabilize Syria, enlarge the caliphate, push it all the way up into Spain. The chances of it happening are extremely low, but once they have been squashed, they will come up in another form. There'll be a new name we get used to. Remember, we all got used to saying Boko Haram about 3 years ago. They've already changed their name, by the way. There will be a new ISIS in two, unless you deal with the ideology.
Yeah, I think Tim's right. I think what worries me about the equation that Tim just described is this idea that, yes, you can, you might be able to get them out of key cities in Syria and northern Iraq, but the problem seems to be that all of the publicity and their very effective propaganda machine is finding sympathy here in Europe and elsewhere. And so even if you can contain them in the areas where they're strong, they seem to be able to build on a supply of people. And also, the problem with modern terrorism, of course, is it just takes one man with a gun, as we saw horrifically this week in Tunisia, and in France as well.
Is this something, though, Tim, that we just have to accept and live with?
No, absolutely not.
We can't. We can't.
But then what do we change then? Because here's the problem, because we always then talk about, well, you know, the original George W. Bush line was, we can't let the terrorists win, we can't change our way of life. However, here are a list of ways we're going to change our lives.
Yeah, and the guy also used the word crusade because he just didn't know his history. Let me quote to you from one of the Saudi papers, Al-Sharq Al-Awsat. This is this week. And it's a very good journalist, Ayad Abu Shakra. And he says, if we ignore the bitter truth and enable the disease to spread until it kills, we can choose to acknowledge its existence in preparation for dealing with it. And he quotes one of his colleagues, Nadim, these killers are us. They are our religion at its most extreme. They are our true Islam taken to its further extent, and they are not beyond the scripture. Now, you've got people like that in the Middle East who get it. They are very lonely figures. I remember all the way back in the 70s, Charter 77 came out of the Czechoslovakia, intellectuals. They were embraced by intellectuals in the West. They were realized that these people need help, that they're not alone. There is a nexus here of decent-minded people in the West who can embrace the genuine voice of modern Islam and stop kowtowing to some of the so-called community leaders and accept that we're in it together to create a 21st century version of this. And the greater 21st century version of it is, the smaller it will be the well from which ISIS draw the recruits that they brainwash to get to kill themselves.
Ultimately, the ownership of this has to come from the region, the region that spawned it, and that's the only way. And I'm not very optimistic about that. You know, first of all, we don't have democracies in the region at all. There's no accountability, and the dictators, whether you call them sheikhs or kings, don't have a broader geopolitical interest. They often would rather see destabilization in their destabilized states and around them.
And yet, just to briefly talk about Western leaders, it's all very well our Western leaders saying, "Well, you know, Muslim leaders need to do this, they need to do that." Tim, you mentioned Saudi Arabia. Saudi Arabia, which is supporting Wahhabism across the region, and yet is still a huge ally for America, for Britain, for many others.
It gets complicated. Yeah. Geopolitics gets involved. All that stuff gets involved. But it doesn't abrogate the responsibility for people to say, hang on a minute. Look, the Saudis are perfectly capable of saying to the British, you're making a strategic mistake by going into Iraq or whatever, and we can listen to it and have a discourse. And we can have a discourse with that side of the fence as well about, and by the way, you guys need to stop
funding this. But that's not happening, is it?
It's not happening enough. I detect there's a slight swing of the pendulum. It is the key issue of our time.
There we are. Okay, finally, let's look to Crimea. The Prime Minister of Ukraine, Arseniy Yatsenyuk, has announced that the Ukrainian Ministry of Culture is in talks with, quote, a world-famous, 3-times Oscar-winning director to make a new film to tell the Crimea region's story. It's a reaction to Russia's own recent effort at Crimea, the road to the motherland, which I'm sure you all saw. Jeffrey, I was just watching it last night. you've seen this, I'm sure.
Before
we try and guess who the world famous 3-times Oscar-winning director is, you know, we talk about soft power and how it can have some influence. When it's this blatant, though,
it's embarrassing.
It kind of doesn't work either way.
Well,
does it?
But he also said that the film would be finished by the end of 2015, and when I saw that, I said, this is just not going to happen.
This is
a man who spoke before he should, and who what it does is reflect a desperate need to take control of the narrative about Ukraine, about Russia's role in Crimea, and to kind of reinforce Ukraine's own self-esteem and the sense of injustice about the annexation of Crimea. It's kind of the filmmaker, whoever he, I guess it must be he, may be. Is irrelevant. It's not. I just don't think it's not going to be made. He'd be anyway. What filmmaker's going to do it for?
Who did the piano? Jane.
Does she have three Oscars?
No, I actually know what they won the Oscars for. It was for Dolly Key Grip. That's the three Oscars.
Right. but briefly, Tim. I mean, surely the bigger problem for Ukraine at the moment is, in terms of propaganda and soft power, is that if you turn on the radio, you turn on the TV in eastern Ukraine, you're getting Russian TV.
You are. I actually had a meeting with Ukrainian diplomats this week, and they are aware that their messaging is not very good. However,
it's much better. Now that they've got a Hollywood guy on their side,
but
or woman.
This is a nonsense. It's an absolute nonsense. I mean, you were sarcastic, nicely, politely sarcastic in your introduction, saying, I'm sure you've all heard of it. No one's heard of it. You know when you get your newspaper, those of us that still read newspapers, and you're flicking through it and then there's this insert, this is sponsored by, and it's a five, you just throw it away, it's the same thing.
There we are. That's all we've got time for on today's Midori House. Thank you very much, Tim Marshall and Jeffrey Kaufman. The programme was produced by Tom Hall, researched by Fernando Augusto Pacheco and Elena Nikulacheva. The studio manager was Toby Hammond. Chris Lord is here next. I'll be back with you at the same time tomorrow, 1800 here in London. I'm Steve Bloomfield. Thanks for listening.